with dozens of window lights that shift colors and gradients. Dark, anonymous avatars walk sideways along other walls, as if the people were held up by strings. Other buildings are painted all in black, with no windows at all. Only thin neon lines that run vertically along its walls. Who knows what the hell goes on inside there? There are spheres that hover in midair, supported by nothing, with no obvious way of getting inside. As we rise as high as the clouds, I can look down and see some of the towers forming circular patterns on the ground, as if they were alien crop circles. We finally reach the floating ramp leading into the pirate's den. Now that we're close enough, I can see how enormous this new ship's masts are, stretching up like screens on the sides of skyscrapers. What I'd seen as gradients of neon colors on the masts are actually advertisements showcasing that day's matches, as well as the current bets on the Phoenix Riders and Team Andromeda rematch. Zero steps off first. He walks onto the ramp and gestures for me to follow. My eyes shift from the broadcasts to the ship's entrance, where dozens of avatars are walking in underneath the pirate's den slogan. Information wants to be free. We step inside. I can hear the pulsing rhythm of my heart in my ears, the blood pumping in time to the soundtrack playing around me, no doubt some stolen track from an unreleased album. Fog hugs the ground. The avatars here are as twisted and strange as ever. A weird mix of people with random, forgettable faces, and users who have remade themselves with monstrous features. But what makes me freeze is the sight of the glass cylinder looming in the center of the cavernous space. The assassination lottery looks like it always does, with its list of names in scarlet letters and the current bid beside each one. Up on the higher deck, and looking down at the list, are assassins and hunters carefully analyzing the list. What looks different is the name at the top of that list. Amika Chen. Current offer, 5,625,000 notes. No wonder everyone's after me. 5,625,000 notes for my assassination. They can't see you, Zero says, cutting through my paralyzing terror. When I glance at him, he gives me a simple nod. I can't see any part of his expression behind his dark helmet, of course, but his body is turned vaguely toward me, giving me the sense that he's protecting me. In spite of everything, I feel oddly safe beside him. It's hard to believe that not long ago, I'd first seen Zero in this very same space as my enemy. The bounty I was hired to hunt down by Hideo. Now, the bounty has reversed. Betting on the final rematch is happening in another corner of the space, while others are clustered in a large crowd around the current Dark Cross game, throwing amounts of money around at an increasingly frantic pace. Over the onlookers is a banner showing the match, followed by how much is at stake. Midnight Raiders versus Hell Dogs. Current odds, 1-4. New game, a voice calls out. An automated announcer is speaking now, its androgynous voice echoing around us. Match ends when a player takes their opponent's artifact. Bets may be placed 2 minutes before the game's opening call and can continue until the official start. I look at the chaotic audience. All of the patrons of the official Warcross teams are public figures with deep pockets, each one well known. But the identities of the patrons of the Dark World teams are a mystery. Rumor has it that they are mafia bosses, gang leaders, and drug lords. None of them are stupid enough to publicly sponsor a team, but one Dark World team can earn double the profits of the Phoenix Riders. No wonder the teams down here can recruit such talented players. Some of them are even ex-Warcross professionals, those whose reflexes can't keep up with the younger upcoming stars. If you don't mind playing an illegal game that could get you arrested at any time, then you'll be showered with riches far beyond that of a legit, official Warcross player in the real world. Of course, as with everything else down here, playing Dark Cross comes with its own unique risks, Unlike Warcross played legally, where the only consequence of losing a game is your money and your ego, the patrons of Dark World teams are a dangerous crowd to disappoint. If you lose enough Dark Cross games, you might see your own name up on the assassination lottery list. I remember one Dark Cross player who was found hanging in his garage, his body bloodied and broken, and another who was pushed in front of a train. Several teams lost their players after the algorithm triggered. Zero goes on as we move to a different part of the den. Here the room is darker and emptier, some distance away from the others, and partially separated by a film of light that acts like a curtain. Of course, this has just made the betting all the more exciting and unpredictable. Is that what we're down here for? The games? I look at him. I thought you were going to show me how to break into Hideo's mind. We are. Zero nods. And I am. How? We recently uncovered a glitch in Hideo's link system. The same system that allows two people to communicate through their thoughts. The glitch only appears if you and I are linked during a game of Warcross. I suck in my breath. What kind of glitch? During a regular link session, you have to get permission from the other person in order to access any of their thoughts. But during Warcross, with the right hack, this glitch allows you into that person's mind and memories without their consent. A glitch that lets you into your linked partner's mind. I imagine a stranger's cold claws piercing my thoughts and memories, me powerless to stop it. How in the world did Zero find a glitch this huge? Zero smiles at my confusion. Even the biggest companies in the world aren't that secure, he reminds me. No wonder we're here. And no wonder Zero has wanted to link with me. I stare up into his black helmet, suddenly feeling very exposed. Zero brought me here to play a game of Warcross while linked. A slight buzzing tickles my ears. It's the same sound I'd heard back during the Warcross Championships, when Zero first interrupted my underwater game with the Phoenix Riders. A clicking sound makes me look down. I'm now encased in dark armor of my own, crimson-red plates in contrast to Zero's black. No doubt that if I were looking at myself, I would see my face hidden behind a helmet. Then the pirate's den vanishes, and I find myself standing in a Warcross world. I'm going to play against Zero, one-on-one. Chapter 8. A one-on-one game of Warcross is called a duel. It's the same game as Warcross itself, except without a team to back you up. And without a team, everything falls onto your shoulders. You are the captain, architect, and thief. You are the fighter and healer. I've watched duels in the Dark World before, but I've never played in one. And down here, where screwing up in a game could endanger my life, I'm not feeling good about my chances. Already, a crowd of gamblers has gathered around, and an announcer has started to take bets for and against each of us. I find myself wondering if anything will happen to me if I lose this game. Just how much do I trust Zero to demonstrate getting into my mind? What if he damages my account permanently? It seems like a lot of trouble to bring me here just for that. But it's hard to be sure of anything with him. Our duel's virtual world is a night setting. Sheets of stars sweep the skies, while streaks of pink and purple linger at the horizon, an image of the minutes right after sunset. Hundreds of giant glass archways curve through the air, each of them reflecting the light. When I look down at my feet, I realize with a start that I'm not standing on solid ground at all, but on the back of a creature. A moving creature. A dragon, as long as a whale. Its scales are illuminated with glowing neon stripes, and its wings are haloed in gold light, as if it were a robot. And when I look closer, I realize that the scales beneath my feet aren't organic, but metallic. I fall to my knees as the beast arches its enormous neck and lets out a column of fire from its mechanical jaws, outlining the clouds below us. Its shriek echoes across the world.
Welcome to the Dragon's Nest, a voice reverberates overhead.
Familiar glowing power-ups materialize in the air, lighting up the evening with their colors. And at the same time, a selection of weapons appears in front of me. Rope, knives, dynamite, gun, bow and arrows, shield. It's a selection of the weapons that each Warcross team player would have, and I'm allowed to choose three of them to hang on my belt. A timer counts down above it. I have 10 seconds. My mind whirls, and I grab for what's familiar to me. The rope, the dynamite. Then I remember that I can't just be an architect. This isn't a game where Roshan can protect me. So I put back the dynamite and grab for the shield and the bow and arrows right before the selection vanishes. I clip on the silver shield arm guards, then swing the arrows over my back and loop the bow across my chest. The gun might be useful, but if I'm on a dragon, then Zero probably will be too, and I might need a way to swing up onto his. Rope and a bow will be my best bet. My dragon swoops toward the closest glass arch to us. I look around for Zero, but see him nowhere. Even as a chant goes up from the black coat spectators, indicating the start of the game, I'm still gliding alone through the air. Reflections from the arches throw me off. I whirl, thinking Zero's behind me, but there are only more clouds. Game. Set. Fight. Suddenly, an enormous shadow lands on top of the arch right over us. A web of cracks jolts across the glass with a deafening splinter. My head jerks up, and I see him there, Zero, on the back of a dragon with scales as black as a rain-soaked raven, its metal spikes shining with edges of dark silver light. His dragon hisses at me, then brings its wings down in one mighty swoop. The glass arch shatters into 1,000 pieces. I throw myself against my dragon's shoulders and cross my forearms to activate my shield. The circular blue field bursts out from my arm guards as glass shards pour down on me. The impact nearly knocks me flat. I flinch as if the weight were real. Player B, life minus 20%. If it weren't for my shield, a hit like that would have easily slashed my life bar in half. And in a real Warcross game, giving my opponent the advantage of a surprise attack like that before the starting call would be impossible. But here, cheats are commonly written in, sometimes as a game progresses live. When is Zero going to show me the hack? A roar from the onlookers fills my ears. I peer up through my shield in time to see Zero leap from the back of his dragon to hurtle down toward mine. He lands on one of its wings, then yanks a sword from his side. He slashes hard into the wing, puncturing the fold, and cuts a deep gash. My dragon screams. It pitches to one side. The sudden lurch sends me tumbling, forcing me to break my arm guard pose. My shield deactivates as I instead grab the edge of one of the beast's scales and hang on. Below us, other dragons glide in and out between the glass arches, black silhouettes against the evening. A series of glowing power-ups hover above them. Golden speed bursts and ice marbles, a sphere of green vines and a fireball. My mind whirls, gauging the distance between me and each of them. That fireball is a flamethrower power-up, strong enough to swallow an opponent whole. The sphere wrapped with vines is a vine trap, capable of entangling a player for 5 seconds, immobilizing them on the spot. I haul myself up along the dragon's scales. Zero lunges for me. I roll to one side before he can seize the glowing artifact hanging over my head. He misses it by a bare inch. I roll over and over as he lunges for me again. My hands fumble for the rope at my waist, but then I feel Zero's hand clamp down on my arm. He pulls me toward him. I grit my teeth and kick. My metal boots hit him in the chest, and I push off as hard as I can. He loses his grip on me. I fling myself free of both Zero and my dragon, then plummet through the air. Wind screams against my ears. As I go, I activate my shield again and turn it at an angle. It catches the air, letting me steer myself slightly sideways. I manage to navigate myself toward the fireball and the vine power-ups. I throw both arms wide, grabbing the two power-ups simultaneously. I look up to see Zero jump from the dragon and follow me down. I pocket the vine power-up, then take the fireball and unleash it, swinging it straight at him. It explodes with a thunderous roar. Flames engulf both Zero and my injured dragon in a giant blaze. Player A, life minus 100%. Player B strikes out player A. I ignore the cheers and boos from the audience. Zero's going to regenerate in no time, and with the way this game's structured, he might have an unfair advantage again. As the wind whistles past my ears, I yank out an arrow strapped to my back holster and frantically knot the rope at my waist to it. I tie the rope's other end around my chest. Then I fit the arrow to my bow right as I fall like a stone past the entire herd of dragons. I twist, point my bow up to the nearest dragon to me, and shoot. The arrow hits true, lodging in between two scales on a dragon's chest. Sparks fly from the burn of the arrowhead's metal against the scales. The beast lets out a roar of annoyance as the rope pulls taut, yanking me to an abrupt halt with it. I pull myself up as quickly as I can as the dragon veers sharply to one side, narrowly avoiding colliding with a glass arch. Above me, Zero reappears on the back of his black dragon. Its ice-colored eyes fix on me, and it plunges in my direction just as I swing myself up onto my new dragon's back. This time, I point my dragon toward the arches. "Higher," I snap, urging it up. It obeys, turning its mechanical head where I want it to. Zero's dragon hurls toward me, its jaws open. It lets out a column of fire. I pull my dragon to one side, just missing it, but some of the flame catches my dragon's wing, scorching the metal black. I force it into a tight spiral around the arch's columns. "What the hell is she doing?" I can hear a couple of the spectators shouting, their words almost drowned out by the cheers. Zero gives chase. He steers his dragon to fly sidelong against mine, avoiding the spiraling pattern that I'm doing. He looks ready to pull in close again and jump onto my dragon's back. I aim for the gently curving top of the glass arch. As I reach it, Zero nears me. I grab my vine power-up in my inventory. If I can lure Zero closer and set it off on him at the right time, it'll ensnare him in its tangle of thick vines and freeze him there, hanging from the top of the arch. I can leap off my dragon and slide down the tangle of vines to grab his artifact. I glance over my shoulder. He's drawing closer now, taking the bait. A small smile threatens to creep onto my face. I turn to stare down at the top of the arch. Time to strike. Then, a flash of light hits me. The world washes out into blinding white. Did the game end? Then I realize a split second later that Zero has used his own power-up on me. A lightning strike. I see the top of the glass arch rushing at me as I fall toward it. I hit it full force without a chance to even pull up my shield. Player B, life minus 60%. Warning. I struggle to my feet as Zero walks to me on top of the arch. Hastily, I bring up my vine power-up and point it at him. The world around me flickers, like static cutting through the air. I blink, frowning. Could everyone see that? Was it just me? Zero's focus is trained on me. As he approaches, he waves his hand in a subtle gesture. The static flickers again. It reminds me of when he took over my view during one of the Phoenix Writers Championship games, how we both ended up in that dark red cavern. I hold a hand out at him, as if that could possibly stop him. "Wait," I start to say. "What are you doing?"
"Time for us to stop playing around," Zero says.
His words echo in my mind through our link. And in the blink of an eye, the virtual world around us shifts into something else. I gasp. It's my old foster home. I'm standing back in those familiar halls, surrounded by peeling yellow wallpaper and slants of gray light. There's a storm raging. The lights outside shuddering with every streak of lightning, the ground trembling with every roll of thunder. Nearby, one of the doors in the hallway, the girls' room, my old room, is ajar from where I'd just crept through. This is the night when I escaped from the foster home. That's impossible.
If I wasn't sitting in a chair in real life, I'm sure my knees would have buckled. My breath comes up shallow. How did Zero create this? How did he know? How did he get inside my head, find this memory, and populate this virtual world around me? The glitch. But when? Did he get in right after I accepted his link invite, just before we headed into our duel? I can't hear the roar of the audience anymore, so I can't tell if they're also seeing what I'm seeing. Just like the championship game and the Red Cavern, I'm probably the only one who knows what's happening to me right now. I tremble at the sight of the hall, at the familiarity of this night. Everything looks the same, except somehow exaggerated, like it might appear in a nightmare. The walls are so much taller than they should be, stretching so high that I can barely see the ceiling, and the patterns on the wallpaper ripple in the light, like it's in motion. When I look down at myself, I realize I'm even wearing the same clothes I'd worn that evening as I made my escape. My worn sneakers, my torn jeans, my faded sweater. The same fear from that evening throbs through my veins. The same thoughts race through me. I'd planned every detail of tonight's escape, counted down from when I saw the light go out in Mrs. DeWitt's room, stashed all I could fit into my backpack. The Dragon's Nest duel has all but vanished from my mind. Gone are the thoughts of winning our game. It's as if Zero had opened a gate into my soul. Every locked door has a key. I whirl to see Zero standing there in the dark corridor, his armor making him nearly invisible in the midnight shadows of the hall, his face hidden from view behind the opaque helmet. That's what you're telling yourself right now, isn't it? Get out of my head, I growl at him. He approaches me, opening one of his hands palm up to reveal a hovering cube, crimson and glossy. This is the hack, the key to this glitch, he says. He hands the cube to me. I can't be here, I whisper. The sight of the foster home is making it hard for me to catch my breath. Get me out. Zero shakes his head. Not until you can do the same to me, he replies. I clench my fists as my fear boils over into anger. I won't say it again. Neither will I. He stands before me, cold and impassible. Look in your memory. Open the cube. Everything around me seems like it's blurring, spinning in a dizzying circle. I try to concentrate, but then the old grandfather clock at the end of the hall starts to chime, and the sound of a muffled voice in the kitchen catches my attention. My heartbeat quickens. I'm back in that awful place again. I'm 14. The clock is chiming 2 in the morning, and I'm out in the hall, sneakers and backpack on, quivering at the sound. I forget that I'm learning a hack. Instead, I bolt away from Zero and run as fast as I can. My shoes catch against the carpet, making me stumble in the same way I'd stumbled that night. Then I'm out of the hall and in the front room of the home, where the main entrance is staring back at me. Hey! A shout behind me makes me look over my shoulder. It's Chloe, one of my older roommates. Her eyes are focused on my backpack and my shoes as she points a finger at me. Mrs. DeWitt! She yells, raising her voice so that it seems to drown the whole house. Amika's running away! I don't know if it's because I'm inside my own memory, but my body does exactly the same thing I did that night. I dart past the kitchen, my eyes on the front door. My legs feel like they're dragging through mud. Then comes Zero's voice again. But I don't care what he wants from me anymore. All I need to do is get out of here. If they catch me, I'm dead. As I reach the door, I start to sprint. A force tackles me from behind. It's Chloe, and suddenly her hands are grabbing for my hair and my throat. We both fall to the floor. I kick blindly at her, as violently as I can. The lights in the farthest bedroom turn on. We've woken up the others. My shoe connects hard with Chloe's face. She lets out a yelp and releases me. Little bitch, she spits as she grabs for me again. I manage to slip out of her grasp, scramble to my feet, and burst through the door out into a stormy night. The grass is so slick that I nearly slip, but I regain my footing in time. The chain-link gate is right in front of me. I slam into it just as I realize that it's held shut with a heavy padlock. Panic ripples through me. My hands hook onto the wiring of the chain-link fence, and I haul myself up, not caring when a sharp edge on the metal slashes a red line across one of my fingers. I crumple in a heap on the other side of the fence, off the property of the foster home. Get up. You can't be here. They'll catch you. Behind me, someone emerges from inside the house. They sweep a flashlight beam across the porch. Faint shouts drift to me in the wet air. I drag myself up to my feet again and dash down the street. I'm not sure if I'm crying in real life or if this is another figment of the memory. All I know is that eventually I huddle in a doorway, almost able to feel the texture of wet wood grain against my hands as I push against either side of the door in an attempt to steady myself. My fingers curl. My nails dig into the chipping paint on the wood. Zero appears on the sidewalk in front of me. Before I can even start thinking about what to do next, he rushes at me with impossible speed. Every single instinct I have as a hunter kicks into high gear. I spin out of the way, my arms up in self-defense to protect my face as he lunges at me. He seizes me by my collar before I can run, then yanks me up onto my feet. He brings his face close to me.
Calm down and think, he says angrily.
The vividness of the memory shudders, and his words cut through my panic. This isn't real. You're not really back here. You're playing in the dark world, inside a ghost from your past. How dare you? A surge of anger hits me, forcing me to focus only on Zero. He has broken into my mind, has violated my privacy yet again.
The cube.
His hack. I stare up at his figure towering over me and bring up the code again. This time, I look inside my memory. There. I can even see what he's done. There is an extra file in my account that shouldn't be there. An access file that the cube had somehow planted. I open the access file he's downloaded into me to see a hidden link between us. The gateway he'd opened up that led me right back to him. Then, I open the cube of data and run it on him. A ring of files appears around Zero, each one a gaping door-like void with a view of another world on the other side. Windows into Zero's mind. I'm in. I don't wait for him to react. I just pick the closest door to me and suck my breath in as his mind suddenly envelops everything around us. The stormy night vanishes. So do the familiar midnight street and the foster home behind chain-link fencing on the other side of the road. New York disappears. Instead, I'm now on a carpeted floor in a strange place. When I look up, I see what appears to be a bedroom. A figure is crouched in one corner, huddled tightly against the wall. I'm in Zero's memories. The figure crouching in the corner of the bedroom now stirs. It's a young boy, with his arms wrapped around his knees. His wrists are bony, protruding from a baggy white sweater. And when I look closer, I notice a symbol embroidered on his upper left sleeve. It's not a mark I've yet seen associated with Zero or the Black Coats, nor is it anything else I recognize. I can't make out his face in the darkness, but my eyes hitch on a thick scarf wrapped around his neck. A blue scarf. The same scarf Hideo had given Sasuke the day he disappeared. The sight startles me so much that I stopped short, frozen in place. I pause long enough that when I blink again, the figure in the corner is gone, and Zero is standing before me again. He reaches out to seize my arm before I can turn away. His hand closes around my wrist, and suddenly, I feel like I'm falling, paralyzed. I try to pull my virtual self back up onto my feet, but it's like I've completely stopped responding. All I can see is Zero standing over my figure, dark armor reflecting the dim light in the boy's bedroom, before it all disappears into darkness. The pirate's den comes back into view. The onlookers around us are riotous, shouting over one another as payouts fly, the transparent numbers over their heads changing wildly. I blink, confused and lost. On a hovering screen, I see a playback of the last moments of the duel. I see the moment when Zero struck me with a lightning power-up, causing me to collapse on top of the glass arch. Zero walks up to me. I run from him along the arch, and I recognize my frantic gestures from when I was running down the hallway in the memory of my foster home. I see myself fight back against Zero, the moments when I'd actually hacked into his memory, only to have Zero paralyze me with a grip of my wrist. Another power-up. He takes my artifact. No one in the audience saw my memory or Zero's. No one has any idea what happened. That Zero had hacked into my mind, or that I had hacked into his. All they witnessed were the same actions playing out in the dual world. They heard none of the things Zero said to me. It had only been through our link, as were my words to him. Some of the onlookers snicker at me, but others seem impressed with the way I played. I nod back at them as if still in a trance. Zero stands beside me. When he looks at me, the black brace around my wrist reappears. "Well done," Zero says. Then the ship fades away, and abruptly, I find myself back in the real world, sitting exhausted in my hotel suite before Zero. He's back in his black outfit and his real body, his cool eyes still studying me like I'm some sort of sculpture. Our duel is done. I can barely remember the dragons and our brief fight. All I can think about is that Zero had dragged one of my worst moments back up to the surface, forced me to relive every awful second. He'd used my greatest weakness, my past, against me. Suddenly, a wild anger sears me to the bone. I feel careless. All I want to do is hurt him back. I lunge across the room at him. Zero sidesteps me like a shadow. I stumble past him, clawing at the air, and fall to my knees. Again, I push myself up and go for him, but he dodges again, as smoothly as if he were toying with me. "I wouldn't," he warns, his eyes flashing. I lean against the room's writing desk and meet his eyes warily. "Your memory," I mutter as I try to steady my breathing. "What was going on in there? Was that when you first disappeared? The symbol on your sleeve?" "Is a memory I didn't intend you to access," he answers, his voice still eerily detached. He puts his hands in his pockets. "What matters is that you were able to get in through the vulnerability exposed by our link, in the same way I used the cube to get into your mind." He gives me a serious look. "That's your ticket in. But be careful on how you use it. Being inside a mind that's not your own means the other's defense will constantly be on the lookout for you. When I seized your wrist, that was my mind realizing you weren't supposed to be in there and pushing you out. It means you won't be able to get back in again." "But what was that room? Where were you?" I press. "And where were you trying to run away to?" he interjects, a sharpness suddenly entering his voice. He gives me a small smile.
You ran from me like you could see nothing through the terror in your memory. Like you didn't want to spend another second in that house.
I close my eyes and fight the massive tide of resistance rising in my chest. Fine, fine, I snap, crossing my arms over my chest. Point taken. You don't ask me, and I won't ask you.
He studies me with a curious gaze, but decides to let his own questions drop. He brings up the glowing cube between us, the key to this hack. For you, he says.
I take it and store it away in my files.
My palms feel clammy.
You'll have every freedom you had before you met us,
Zero continues.
If you need any equipment, let me know. Jax mentioned you lost your board during your escape. I'll have a new one sent for you. Keep me updated on how things are going between you and Hideo.
I nod without saying a word. The thought of me invading Hideo's memories, the way Zero just did mine, makes me feel sick.
It's nothing that he isn't doing with a Neuralink, I remind myself, in much worse ways than that. Zero pauses at my door for a moment. When he glances at me over his shoulder, there's something else in his gaze. Something stiff, as if I'd struck a nerve.
I didn't know which memory of yours would appear, he says.
It's almost an apology. I don't know what to make of it. All I can do is stand here quietly, fishing for the right words, trying not to let my mind linger on the night of my escape and the terror of crouching alone in that doorway. It's strange, this moment. It's almost as if he'd let down his guard to reveal a hint of his opaque interior.
But it lasts only for a second. Then he steps out of my room, leaving me alone with my endless questions. I think of Sasuke's small figure, huddled in a corner. His blue scarf, given to him by the brother he doesn't seem to remember loving, wrapped desperately around his neck. The way he clung to it, as if it were all he had in the world. Most of all, I linger on the glimpse of the mystery symbol embroidered on his sweater. I pull the image up again now and let it hover before me. Why did he let me see such a personal memory? Why was it so easy for me to access? It could be that it was just a random mistake, just like I never meant for him to see mine. But Zero is one of the most powerful hackers I've ever met. How could he be careless enough to expose this sensitive moment from his past to me? I stand there quietly, struggling to figure him out. Why does Hideo's name mean nothing to you? Who took you? What does that symbol mean? What happened to you?
Chapter 9. True to his word, Zero has a new board sent up for me within hours. This one is all black, from surface to wheels to bolts. I test it out tentatively, letting myself adjust to its weight and traction. It should be good for traveling at night. I stay in the hotel room until it's fully dark outside, inspecting the corners of the walls, searching for signs of hidden cameras or some other surveillance. Then I run a careful check on my account, in case Zero has indeed installed some kind of tracker on my system in addition to my black cuff. To my surprise, I find nothing. Maybe Zero and Taylor are serious about giving me my privacy. From the balcony, I can see the silver and blue overlays on the streets below, showcasing the area's loyalty to Team Winter Dragons. The hotel is somewhere in the middle of Omotesando, a glittering upscale district full of luxury shops housed inside grand architecture. Silver and blue lights wrap around every tree. Purses and shoes on display in store windows sport bejeweled crests from the Phoenix Riders and Team Andromeda, celebrating the final. Since I first arrived, Another 2 top players have been announced for the closing ceremony, and now their images are being broadcast against the windows of Prada and Dior.
Shahira Bulos of Turkey, Andromeda. Roshan Ahmadi of UK, Phoenix Writers.
It occurs to me that Jax had brought me here in a state of unconsciousness. Now the black coats are letting me step out the door unattended and fully alert. I don't quite believe it. I could easily go back on my word to them. But there's not much I could do to them at this point. I don't know where they are or anything incriminating about them. Get into Hideo's mind. That's what the black coats are asking of me. I look in the direction of Tokyo Dome, where enormous virtual symbols for the Phoenix Writers and Team Andromeda are already hovering in the night sky above the stadium, with a timer counting down the next 24 hours until the game happens. Hideo will be at the final rematch tomorrow. My thoughts wander back to Zero. I'd spent a moment running searches on the symbol on Sasuke's sleeve, but no matches turned up. It doesn't belong to any corporation I've ever heard of, nor does it resemble anything that might hint at what it is. It's simply a series of polygons overlapping each other, as abstract as anything can be. I quietly put a call out to Tremaine. He answers almost immediately.
"Hey!"
he exclaims in my ear so loudly that I wince. An instant later, his virtual figure appears, and I see him walking on a crowded, brightly lit street, his hands buried in his pockets. "A little quieter," I reply. "I can hear you fine."
"Where the hell are you?"
Tremaine squints at me, trying to make sense of my surroundings.
"Are you okay? The riders are freaking out about you. Roshan even called me to see if I knew what was going on."
"Where are you?" I ask.
"Someplace in Roppongi. Where are you? I've been trying to track you down."
His hurried voice makes my mind whirl. "Amoto-san, though, don't track me. It's too dangerous. I'll come find you."
"What do you mean it's too dangerous? I heard about gunfire in Shinjuku a couple of days ago. It was all over the news. They said some kind of madman opened fire. It's unheard of in Japan, even in Kabukicho. 2 people were killed. I thought one of them could have been you. What happened?"
It already seems like years since I last talked to them in the bar. I bite my lip. "I'm okay," I reply. "It's a long story. I'll explain when I see you." I keep my voice low. "But first, I need you to look at something for me." Before Tremaine can answer, I send him the screenshot of young Sasuke in the room. His bewildered voice now turns curious.
"Who's this?"
"Sasuke Tanaka, apparently, when he was young. See that symbol on his sleeve?"
"Yeah. What is it?"
"I have no idea. That's what I need your help with."
"You run a search on it yet?"
"Yeah, I turned up nothing." Tremaine pauses, and I imagine him studying the symbol with a frown, trying to match it up with something. He finally murmurs under his breath.
"I'm not finding anything on it either. Not on a first try. But I think I know someone who can help. Where'd you get this screenshot?"
"That's part of the long story." I glance out my balcony, looking on as icons blink on across Tokyo's landscape wherever my eyes sweep. "Tomorrow night, after the final rematch, let's meet up with the others and I'll tell you what I know."
"Hopefully I'll have something for you by then."
He nods at me, and we disconnect. The paranoia hits me instantly. What if Zero had overheard my conversation with Tremaine? I haven't forgotten what happened to me the last time I was out in public alone, just a few short days ago. Now I'm sitting safely in a hotel room, but I still can't ignore the feeling that someone might burst in at any moment. "Concentrate." I am about to place another call, this time to the Phoenix Writers, when a movement out near my balcony makes me freeze. I crane my neck, eyes searching for a moment, until I see that someone has emerged onto the balcony of Jax's suite next to mine. It's Zero. The glow from the city sprawl below outlines his shape in dim light. He stares out at the landscape for a moment, his eyes sweeping slowly toward my room. I want to turn my gaze away in case he can see me watching him. A voice says his name, and Zero turns as Jax joins him on the balcony. I hold my breath, looking on as she stops before him. She's fiddling with her gun again, just as she'd done when she was with me, taking out its cartridge and clicking a new one into place, her movements subtle and efficient. It's as if the habit comforts her. As I look on, Jax takes a step closer to Zero, so that she is nearly touching him, and then she says something to him that I can't hear. Something softens in his expression. He leans toward her and closes his eyes, then murmurs something into her ear. Whatever it is, it makes her shift slightly in his direction. They don't touch. All they do is stay that way, locked in a subtle embrace, sharing something that makes me think of the way Hideo used to pull me to him. He follows her back inside, and then the two are gone. I find myself breathing again, my cheeks flushing slightly at the scene. There's an undeniable familiarity between them. Moments later, her front door clicks shut. I don't know where she's going, but the fact that she's gone makes my shoulders sag a little in relief. Maybe Zero's gone with her. Or maybe she's alone now, and watching me. After all, Zero had told me that she would be looking out for my well-being. I take a deep breath, then send out a joint invite to the Phoenix Riders. Asher connects first, and before long so do all the others. They're back in Asher's home, no doubt prepping for tomorrow's game. He lets out a long breath at the sight of me, while Hammy spits out a curse and crosses her arms. About time, she snaps at me. We were about to report you missing to the police, Asher adds, one of his hands tapping on his wheelchair's armrest. Except that would alert Hideo that something was wrong with you. I'll explain everything, I say in a low voice. But first, I need a favor. What is it? Roshan asks. When do you all head out to Tokyo Dome tomorrow? Right around sundown. Hanka Games is sending calls for us. Why? I need to be in the dome with you, I say. In the restricted areas, where only the players are allowed. I need access to Hideo. What's going on? Hammy asks. It's Zero, isn't it? I glance toward the balcony again, lingering on the empty spot where Zero and Jax had just been moments earlier. Yeah. At that, Hammy uncrosses her arms, blinking rapidly. Okay. I didn't think you seriously contacted him. I didn't. He contacted me. I hesitate. He saved me from a few Dark World assassins who were out for a bounty on my head. What? Hammy's eyes widen even more at that, while Roshan leans forward, muttering a rare curse under his breath. You should have told us, he says. I decide not to mention my accidental call to Hideo yet. I'm okay, I reply. And yes, he did make me an offer. It's too much to explain like this, but listen. If they're serious about what they want me to do, I'm going to need your help. Chapter 10. 4 days until the Warcross closing ceremony. In the history of the Warcross championships, there has never been a rematch of any kind, and what that means this afternoon, hours before the game starts, is that no one really knows how to celebrate it. The districts of Tokyo, previously lit up in the colors of each neighborhood's favorite professional team, are now lit again in either red and gold or blue and silver. Footage from the first final replays along the entire sides of skyscrapers. I pass a line of tricked-out supercars on display down one street. Lamborghinis, Bugattis, Porsches, Luminati Xs, the fastest electric car currently on the market. Each of them sporting neon blue or red lights installed along the bottoms of their doors, and rims decorated in the colors of the rival teams. With the Neuralink, they transform into vehicles that look impossible. Cars with virtual wings. Cars that look like jets with trails of flames behind them. They'd been out during the first final. Now, with the rematch,
They're at it again. The drivers arguing in the streets. Vendors selling merchandise, hats and shirts, figurines and keychains, have pulled out their leftover wares from the first final. Their faces look haggard and stressed as they run out of supply and try to bring in more. I glimpse a few figurines of myself among those being sold, my rainbow hair painted onto the toys in globs of gradient colors. It's a surreal sight. 8 streaks of laser lights suddenly zip past overhead at blistering speed, leaving rainbow-hued lines in the air and causing the crowds on the ground to let out surprised cheers. Drone racing, I think. Like street racing with cars, it's strictly illegal. These participants must all still be on beta lenses. I've even hunted a few drone racers down in the dark world before and released their info to police. Racers must be feeling pretty bold tonight. But with the cops preoccupied with security for the rematch and breaking up scuffles between rival fans, tonight's their chance to show off. People I pass on the streets argue heatedly in favor of either team. Entire groups of fans dressed as the teams are actually facing off on street corners, some of them shouting. A few yells come in my direction from clusters of Andromeda cosplayers.
"Why are you dressed as a cheater?" one shouts.
He's almost immediately answered by calls from Phoenix Riders supporters.
"Amika Chen for life!"
I just keep my head lowered and focus on riding my board down the street. At least there are 3 other girls dressed up in some variation of Amika Chen, and no one seems interested in looking my way for long. Besides, if what Zero said is true, it means I'm no longer a mark to all the hunters and assassins who have been trying to get to me. Maybe Jax is guarding me from somewhere, but I don't see her. By the time I near Tokyo Dome's amusement park, some of my nerves have faded, and I feel more like myself as I make a smooth turn onto the sidewalk. A message comes in from Hammy, asking me to accept. I do, and a private virtual image of her appears next to me, looking as real as reality. Her hair is in dozens of braids tonight, with gold and crimson woven into them, and her dark eyelids are coated with glitter. After 2 days with the black coats, I'm so happy to see her that I almost try to hug her projection. "You look ready," I say to her. Hammy rolls her eyes at me.
"If one more person touches my hair, I'm gonna knock their head off."
She points toward the back of the dome.
"It's the tunnel they take us through," she says. "Except there won't be any guards or fans. Watch for me."
A golden line appears in my view, guiding me along the path she wants me to take. I nod once, then steer myself in the right direction. Soon I've made my way close enough to the dome's sprawling entertainment complex to see the enormous team portraits of each of tonight's players hovering over each lamppost. The surrounding complex itself, Tokyo Dome City, is teeming with people, just as it had been during the regular championship season. The amusement park's rides are lit up in different colors, and through my lenses, I can see an entire carousel of landscape options for me to choose from. When I select a fantasy option, the entire park transforms into a medieval-looking kingdom, with the dome as an enormous castle before me. When I select a space option, the park shifts yet again into a futuristic station on an alien planet, with giant rings arching across the night sky. I hop off my ride and walk into the complex to join the masses. At least it's easy to get lost in the crowd. People gather around rides and shops, their attention focused away from me. I slip through the throngs without a trace. Lines of people are gathered near the entrance, waiting to check into the stadium. The gold line veers sharply around them. I follow it until I've passed the main entrance gates, bustling with fans. Before long, the black gates come into view, heavily barricaded and swarming with guards. Rows of black cars wait in anticipation of the match's end. Even though tonight's game is just between the Phoenix Riders and the Andromedans, all the other teams are here to watch. Crowds of fans linger at the edges of the barricades, hoping to be one of the first to peek at the teams when they leave.
"Here," I murmur to Hammy in a message.
"I see you," she replies.
"When I say go, close climb over the left barricade closest to the gate. Then she goes dark. A few minutes later, a riotous commotion suddenly starts at the barricades closest to the back gate. Asher appears, with Hammy and Roshan flanking him on each side, their professional grins on and their hands waving in the air. Behind them come Jackie Nguyen and Brenner Lyons, the replacements for Ren and me. Hammy's already dressed in Phoenix Rider Scarlet, the outfit hugging her curves, and her familiar little smirk is prominent on her face. Asher's sitting in a new black and gold designer wheelchair, and Roshan looks sleek with his head of dark curls, carefully combed and his outfit spotless. The fans burst into shouts and screams. A wave of flashing lights engulfs the team. People rush the barriers closest to them, forcing all the security to hurry to contain them. I smile at their surprise appearance. Perfect. Over the crowds, Hammy sends me a quick message. Go. As security struggles with the concentration of fans on one side, I swing myself quietly over the other and dart in toward the gate. A few others try to follow me, which is when Hammy raises the alarm, pointing exaggeratedly at the few fans now trying to come over the barrier. A couple of guards rush to intercept them, and I disappear into the dark recesses of the entryway. All I can see here are the dim blue outlines of silhouettes. The corridor brings a wave of nostalgia, and I think back to being led out into the arena by a team of bodyguards, my heart pounding in anticipation of the war draft. That wasn't so long ago, but it feels like an eternity. Ash, I message him as I make my way down the familiar halls. Can you make sure the security cams in the Phoenix Riders' waiting room are off? Before every game, the Riders wait in an elegant suite overlooking the expansive arena. Already done. Careful of the hall leading to our room, though. They installed some new cams there, and we couldn't gain access to any outside our suite. I shrink further underneath my hoodie. Got it. Meet us afterward. He sends me an address. We'll talk then. Finally, I reach the writer's empty waiting room and slide the door shut behind me. The silence in here is punctuated by the muffled noise coming from down below, where 50,000 fans are cheering as the latest track from BTS thunders from the speakers. I stand before the window, feeling for a second like I've gone back in time to when I was still a player. The stadium is completely packed, with more people streaming into their seats with each passing second. An announcer is recapping the original final game as footage plays in the enormous 3D holograms. A glowing light is already flashing over the suite's door, calling for the players to head down to the center of the arena. Analysts sitting in the top rows broadcast their debates, predicting which team has the best chance of winning. My attention turns to the private glass box on the other side of the arena. In there, I can see several figures moving around that I identify as Hideo, Mari, and Ken. On the ground level, the first members of Team Andromeda have started emerging into the center of the arena. The crowd's screams rise a deafening octave. Good luck, I murmur to my team as they start appearing too. My gaze lingers a while longer on their sleek outfits. Even after everything, the energy in this space fills every inch of me, and I want nothing more than to be down there with them, soaking in the world's applause, and wondering what new fantastical realm I'd be dropped into next. I want to be excited again with my whole heart, before everything became so complicated. I shake my head, take a seat, and pull up a grid of the entire dome's security cams. There's more surveillance in this dome than I've seen anywhere else. At least two or three cams in each room. It seems they've added layers of security since the breach that nearly killed Hideo. When Jax nearly killed Hideo, I remind myself as a shiver runs through me. The announcer finishes introducing each of the players. The lights in the stadium dim, leaving only the teams illuminated, and in the center of the arena, a hologram appears to show the world that everyone will be immersed in. It's somewhere high in the sky, shrouded by clouds in every direction,
and piercing through the cloud bank are hundreds of narrow mountain peaks with towers on top, each connected to the others around it with narrow rope bridges.
"Welcome to the Sky Kingdom," a familiar omniscient